Now, he gives me pleasure to introduce my good friend, Luke.
My name's Luke, and I am an alcoholic. I'm sure I get that right. I want to say thanks to Al and the committee, I guess, that you've got a committee here now. Seems like you guys are getting pretty structured. It's really nice. And birthday people and to the newcomers, man. Hopefully you'll hear something tonight that may allow you to get another day sober. I don't know, man. Life is, what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And I experienced strength and hope. And that's what I get to share with you guys tonight. You know, this has been my spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. This has been the journey that I'm on that I believe was divinely inspired and intervened in my life to allow me to be here tonight and to be sober at all, anywhere. What it was like, I'm an immigrant from Holland. I grew up and came here when I was 3 years old. So, my family, they didn't speak the language when we got here. We had to, my parents had, had to go through all the being an immigrant family and stuff. And we got laughed at and we got mocked and, all that kind of stuff. I was pretty young. I really don't remember a lot of it. But, I remember this one story before we were playing baseball. We were in Middle League already. And, one guy was just making fun of my dad, and it just pissed me off, and it just made me feel different. But, growing up was really a good thing for me. I had a good family. And my parents came here in 1962. We became citizens in 1968. And we got to live the American dream. My parents got to live the American dream. My dad owned his own business, started his own business, and that business was in functioning for the last 50 years, and my brother just sold it a year and a half ago. And at one point in my life, I was president of that company. And, doing what we do and living the way we live, I was asked to leave that company. And that was a very difficult time in my life. I felt excommunicated from my family. I felt unloved. I felt unneeded. I felt thrown away. And so what I did was I pulled the home equity line of credit on my house, and I lived like a rock star for a year. Didn't change my life. Didn't change what I was doing. And I just continued on partying on. To preempt that, growing up, like I was saying, it was very European, it was very strict, and it was very disciplined. And so there was a lot of fear in the house, right? I mean, my dad ruled roost, and he said jump, and you jump. And, there were some things that happened, back in the day that, would not be acceptable today, right? And what it did was really just kind of continue to make me more and more fearful. And I wasn't allowed to do anything until I turned 16. I wasn't allowed to have sleepovers or go to sleepovers. I wasn't allowed to go to the movies. I wasn't allowed to do anything. My parents never gave me the opportunity to learn any responsibility and to be accountable, and they never learned to trust me with anything. And so when I turned 16, you know, I got a license. It was a vehicle that I shared with a brother. And I have two older brothers. And so, you know, it started a little bit because, you know, now all of a sudden I have this freedom at 16. And I have no experience in living, you know, and feeling like, you know, I wanted to belong. I wanted to fit in now. You know, I had been such an outcast for a long time. All those years, I felt like an outcast. You know, 7th, 8th grade, I remember I had this girlfriend, and we were supposed to meet at the cinema, and every week I'd say, yeah, I'm going to be there. But I had too much pride, or too much ego, or too much low self-esteem to tell her what was really going on, and I told her I'd be there, and I never showed up. You know, it was terrible. You know? It was terrible. And those things, you know, when you look at it today, you know, those things affect you at a different level. They affect you at your core. They affect you on the inside. Because on the outside, you may look all right, but on the inside, see, so you start getting that damage on the inside, and you just start to learn to touch things at an early age. You know? I'll tell you about this, my first little spiritual experience, or first thing that got me to, I was in 5th grade. My parents, we grew up downtown over by Fester Street, and then my parents built a house across the woods back in like 66, 67. So we were like the 5th house out there. There was nobody out there, and the Orchid was like 15 miles out of town. You know, it was a long way. And J.C. Penney was the end of town, right? That used to be the end of town when we grew up. And that was new. You know? So, you know, I mean, you know, so I felt like an outcast. And here I am living out there while my friends are down here. And I remember I'd ride my bike back downtown. And, you know, then my parents would have to come pick me up. And they got so mad at me and made me ride my bike home at night, you know. And I'm 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. You know, and, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where you had to learn a lesson, right? You had to learn the lesson. And so, anyway, I'm on the playground at Lake Christian School, and that was an elementary school back in the day, and I remember it was after school, and there was nobody around, and we used to be at Tesla all the time. We always had everybody was there playing sports. And now we moved out there, so I'm over at the playground assuming that there's going to be the same thing going on out there. Well, it wasn't like that. Everybody went home. Nobody was around. There was no kids my age to play with. And I remember I had the basketball, you know, and I'm sitting on the basketball, and this is Ottenbright. She was his teacher, my 5th grade teacher. And I remember everybody was gone. It was, I don't know, in the afternoon. And I remember sitting on this basketball, and I remember I was sitting there, and I was crying. I was crying as a little kid, right? And just have no friends. I had nobody to play with, right? And she said to me, you know, just, you know, ask God to come into your heart. And that was the first time I'd ever had any kind of inkling about God. I wasn't raised in a church. I didn't know anything about God or any of that kind of stuff. And so that was like my first thing I ever recognized. You know, and so, you know, it was challenging to grow up in that kind of isolation almost out there, you know. And, you know, there's another member in this group here that she's not here tonight, but Sarah, she lived out there also. And so I got to be friends with Sarah and her brother Matt, and there used to be horses there and stuff like that. And used to, you know, ride her horse. She had a horse. And So, I mean, you start connecting, but it wasn't the same, right? And my parents always said if they knew how it would had affected me, they would have probably not moved out there. They would have probably moved somewhere else. Now, I don't know if that's got anything to do with me becoming an alcoholic or not. It doesn't really matter, right? It doesn't really matter. You know, but that was one of the very first things, or probably the very first thing, that there was an acknowledgement of a power greater than myself that's available to me. Didn't understand it, didn't want it, didn't recognize it for what it was. It just was what it was. And so, anyway, there's so much that went on in our lives, right? And so much that started to happen during those young years. And, you know, when I got to high school, I was playing sports at Orton Junior High and played basketball, did all this stuff, and played sports all through high school, and was a four-year letterman, and, you know, got my varsity letter as a freshman, and, you know, played basketball at Hancock, blew out a knee at Hancock, so I didn't play any more ball. But before then, in my senior year, after I turned 16, I wanted to fit in, right? So I'm trying to fit in, and I'm able to drive. And when I was 17, my junior year was my best year. That was the year I had the most fun, I felt part of, and, you know, I hadn't gone to the point where my life was consumed by alcohol and drugs. You know, the first time I drank, I was 14 years old, and we mixed all these booze together, and we put it in a pint bottle, me and this friend of mine. And we got so drunk, I got sick, puked all over my friend's car. He was already 16, right? Because he was already 16. And so they dropped me off at some girl's house, and I remember, you know, just not even remembering anything, you know? And then I got home, and we all sat around the dinner table, and my parents didn't say a word about it. They didn't say nothing to me about being drunk. You know, and I asked my mom about that recently. Well, my mom passed away 2 years ago, but I asked her about that. I said, how come you never told me anything about that? Why didn't you guys do anything? She said, well, we thought you'd just grow out of it, or we thought that was at the phase or something. Wouldn't do you any good. Well, lo and behold, I wound up here. With all the pillars of society. So, you know, I mean, there's so many things that go on. I mean, you know, in my life, you know, I mean, 17, 18 years old, I'm a senior in high school now, and one of my friends, you know, he's doing the outside issues and dealing and stuff like that, so I became the driver. We were going to Santa Barbara, and we were getting pounds, and we were getting bricks of hash, and we were bringing back cocaine. And we're doing all that. Here I am, 17, 18 years old, not even realizing what I'm doing. And this is back in 77, 78. You know, so I was really putting my family at risk, myself at risk, and I had no conscience of it. It didn't matter. I just wanted to fit in and be cool. See, I still hadn't had enough self-esteem in myself, self-worth, to be able to say, that isn't the right thing to be doing. But I was already gone, see. I started with two older brothers, like, you know, they're already having drinks, and they're friends, and I'm friends with all the older guys, and so that was my world then. I started, you know, just hanging out with them, and they were always going out and doing stuff, and I was always invited along, because I was a young kid. I was the younger brother, and everybody liked me, it seemed like. So, you know, I did what I did. And I remember going to playing basketball at Hancock, and I remember I was kind of like the team dealer or whatever, always had, right? And I was a lousy dealer, right? I was like the worst dealer of all, you know. I mean, I'm just... So anyway, I remember we were at the Modesto tournament, and I had to, like, one of the starters in my room, and remember it was like room check, 10 o'clock, you know, and coach came by, opened the door, and there's some beer or bong, and a bag of weed sitting on the table, right? He closed the door. He says, okay, good night. You know? And obviously, I didn't. And then later, at the Modesto tournament, me and one of the other guys, this man, him and I, we had the band, right? And we'd go have like a voucher to go eat, so we would go to Sambo's and stuff like that. And we went over and we ate, and I remember we were bailing out of there, and we ran on the check, right? And here we go, it's got Alan Hancock College. Great man. But then anyway, he had a great idea, and I was down with it, and he said, hey, let's get some booze. So we went and bought some of them tequila sunrises, and we drank some of those tequila sunrises, and needless to say, we got smashed, right? And then we had to go back to the gym. Well, I got caught. But, you know, Pop Owens, I don't know if anybody ever remembers Pop Owens. He was the trainer at Hancock, and he was and so I went over there. So I didn't get to play. And I you know, and that kind of set the tone for my career at Hancock anyway. You know, and I was just blowing things off. I was blowing things off. I couldn't go to practice without being loaded. Right? Could not do it. Could not. You know, I was 17, like I say, you know, I was getting loaded morning, noon, and night. Every single day, all day long. You know. And so anyway, got out of Hancock and went to work for a while, working on jobs and doing different things. And worked for CBS Records and Piper Aircraft and Coca-Cola. You know, but it just wasn't really what I wanted to do. Both my brothers had gone to, you know, university, went to Poly and got their degrees, and I wasn't the degree kind of guy, and my degree was something else. So I liked that better. Seemed like it was up my alley. And so anyway, I did that for a couple years, and then I went to work for my dad. I asked my dad if I could work long, and then he worked for him for a couple of years. And he didn't pay me any more than starting wage. He didn't give me anything, you know. That's just not the way it went. And I started at the bottom, and you know, that was all good. And you know, but when I was 19, I remember I was still living at home, right? And this is after Hancock, just after Hancock, and I'm getting loaded living out here local, right? And so anyway, you know, he says, you got to move out. So he gave me 3 weeks. He says, at the end of the month, you got to go. So I was like, okay. So I moved out, and I moved over here to Lincoln Street, was the first place, and you know, it became the party house, is what it was. It was my house, it was another party house, and you know, it was a lot of fun. You know, it was fun then still. It hadn't got to the point where, you know, I had seen any, I thought that was just normal. I didn't see it any differently. But, you know, it was part of what I needed to do to start to grow up, you know, and to learn to start to be accountable and responsible. Yeah. I couldn't really afford to live there on what my dad was paying me, so I was working at this drive-in liquor, I mean, very last drive-in liquor on the end of town over here on the west side, and it was called Vic's Drive-In Liquor, and, you know, and so we always had a free supply of beer, you know, and so that was all part of the package too. But, you know, I don't know, you know, when I think about the stuff that I did and the scrapes that I got out of, you know, I mean, you know, I talk about this sometimes, you know, it's kind of like, you know, that was when I'm still young. That's not even when I got back. That was good. That was normal, you know. And when I got kicked out of my family business, laid on the couch for that year, you know, pulled that home ec line and went to the lake 3 days, 4 days a week, and stopped at Jocko's and partied every night. And money was running thin, so I decided I needed to try to go back to work. So I got a job in either Monterey or in Santa Rosa. And so I chose Santa Rosa because it was farther away from my family. I didn't want anything to do with them anymore. Obviously, they didn't want anything to do with me. So it was like, F you, right? Resentment, right? Didn't know that's what it was called. So anyway, I went up there and did pretty good for a couple of years. But either I was drinking like a fish, or I was doing a bag of cocaine. Either way, right? Either way, I was not doing really that well. It was a facade. And everything in my life was a facade. I could always pull it together or make it look like it was always okay, but it really never was. I mean, the first time I went to rehab, one time in 1986, and this is before I got kicked out of my family business, and they made me sign a contract, you ever get loaded again, you're out. Well, I got loaded again, and I couldn't tell them about it, and so I got behind the green door. And that's my perception of it. I've totally forgiven them for the way I felt about it. But I am forgotten because I know how I felt about it. You know, and, you know, so I moved up there and I was doing the same thing up there. Drinking and using, thinking I could still pull it off. And I couldn't. And I went to, was up there, and you know, I had a friend up there who was a boat racer. He lived in Petaluma, and you know, so he was doing blow, and so we were doing a lot of that. And then, you know, I had this nice truck, and that truck wound up missing. The truck wound up, and you know, because I needed the money, you know. I think that's the first time I ever shared that from the podium. But, you know, that's one of those statute of limitations things that I came in here with. And insurance fraud scientist. And so anyway, I, you know, and then I pulled it off for a little while up there. But then I found the difference in substance, which took me and just took me away. You know, I stopped doing cocaine because I hated to come down, and I couldn't come down, so I just used more, and then I hated to come down, so I had to use more. And I had, you know, it was just the cycle, right? So then I found methamphetamine, and I loved that shit, right? And it was like I didn't have the come down, I didn't have the, you know, the blues, I didn't have any of that stuff. And, you know, I just go 4, 5, 6 days and I go to sleep for like 5 hours and wake up and I'm still loaded and I just start all over again for another 4, 5, 6 days. You know, I'm back here, I weigh 218 pounds, I'm 300 pounds right now. You know, it's like, come on, I'm a little chubby.
Life's good, bro.
And, you know, so I did the deal up there, and, you know, I bought a house up there and sold that house all within a year behind this disease. You know, my parents were loaning me some money to buy that house. I sold that house. I kept the money that I had left over. I used it just to survive. And from that point forward, for the next two and a half years, I was just living flop house to flop house. I was homeless. I was unemployable. I was just gone. And I remember my parents, I hadn't been home in a couple of years, and, you know, I hadn't seen them, and they were really getting worried about me, and my brother was there. Hey, yo. And, you know, my brother was home, you know, and they wanted me to come home for Thanksgiving. And, you know, I pretty much ran it all out up there, you know. And I had a girlfriend, you know, and so anyway, my parents decided they would go ahead and wire me some money. So they wired me some money. You know, fancy cars were gone, the businesses were gone, the two houses were gone, everything's gone. And I'm wearing sweats, like just to stay warm. That's all the clothes I had. I came in here wearing sweats all the time. You know, and, you know, I didn't even think it was that bad. I thought things just were going my way. They couldn't see that I was that sick. See? You know, we don't ever see, the denial is so strong in people like us that we never want to take a look at ourselves and admit to ourselves that we're powerless over any kind of substance, alcohol or whatever our thing is. The combination, you know, it about killed me. It was almost like a hope to die wish, you know. Really, it was. I didn't really care feeling the way I felt. I didn't care anymore. You know, and, you know, you look at the funny stuff that went on. Well, it's really funny, but, you know, you look at all the things that have gone on, and some of it's funny, some of it's not funny, because now we're in recovery, we can look back at it and go, wow. But, you know, there's been so much. I mean, when you know, in my life, when I talk about a divine intervention in my life, I believe that. And I believe that to my core, because I had a sister that died before I was born. She was 5 years old, and her name's Ren. And she's always been my guardian angel, you know, and I always have these angels in my room, and I put my little tokens, my sobriety tokens, in this little angel and let her hold it for me. And, you know, it's very important to me, that little symbolism. I feel a connection. But what it does is it makes me realize that there is a loving God, you know. There is a loving God. And I found that out by working the steps here. See, by not understanding anything about the steps or about recovery or about a loving God or anything like that in my life. But, you know, when I did the steps, when I admitted I was powerless over all of my life, was unmanageable, that was, okay, the first thing, you know. I knew it, but I didn't really, whatever. I'm taking the first step. The first step, I did it. I did the writing. Okay. Right? The second step, where the insanity, right? Now, after I had, I don't know, a little bit of time, maybe 30 days or so, I could see that my actions, I was sober. I hadn't had 3 days sober. I hadn't had 3 days sober in over 7.5 years of that relapse. So now that I had a little bit of time in recovery, I could see that my actions, my behaviors, and my thinking started to change. See? And now I realized that I was not doing that on my own. Right? That there had to be something more powerful than me, whether it was a group of drunks, whether it was a loving God, or whatever. Well, what it did is it gave me the willingness to be able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. To a power that I still don't understand, but I know is there. Right? And I'll tell you this. I mean, I share this, and it's not for any other reason. It's just to let you know that I believe this. I've been missed planes that have crashed. I've been run over by a car. I've been hit in the head with a baseball bat. I've been submerged in a pond in a wrecked car. I lived through my addiction. You know, I had my spiritual experience on in my fifth grade year. It was like, okay, something's happening here. You know, the things that I don't understand are happening in a way that it's all starting to come together. So I was able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God and step through. But that was a serious thing for me. That wasn't like one of these little, I did that. It wasn't like the first step. It wasn't like the second step. The second step was a little like, okay, I'm getting it. But the third step was really big, because not only did you guys tell me that I needed to take a third step, but it was a personal relationship now. Because I was powerless in my first few steps, and now I needed to be empowered to work the rest of the steps and look at myself, right? Well, I took that third step, and what it did for me was made me realize that everything is necessary for my spiritual growth, and that I got no more excuses to go get loaded. See, did I or did I turn my life over to the care of God? Yes, I did. You know, like my sponsor says, what are you tripping on? I'm going to say one bad word. What are you tripping on, fucker? Right? And today, that relationship continues to grow because I work at it, right? My sponsor is a guy named Stevie, and he's got hair down to here and a beard down to here. And, you know, you'd look at him and you'd say, you don't ever judge a book by its cover, people, you know, because you're going to short yourself, you know, humility is a good thing to acquire around here. You know, I have my story. You guys all have your story. You know, some of you guys think, God, you're the worst thing that's ever happened in the thing. And what I've realized is I'm just a garden variety drug addict alcoholic trying to stay sober just like the next guy. You know, my experience is going to be able to help somebody who's been through something similar to me. And your experience is going to be able to help somebody who's gone through something similar to what you've been through. That's how this thing works. You know, it's a blessing to be able to be in recovery. You know, I 12 years sober, I lost my wife. Let me tell you a couple of things. Let me take you back. When I got here, after that Thanksgiving dinner, my dad asked me to leave. My girlfriend came down. I was at the Tweaker Lodge over on Main Street. And came out of that room that morning, you know, and I stood on the railing thinking, God, I used to own this town. I used to be somebody, you know. And I was just nothing. And I had that moment of clarity, whether either you're going to get clean and sober, or you're going to go live under the bridge. What do you want to do? And so what I did is I went over and sat on a friend's porch, and his name was Ray J. And Ray allowed me to sleep on his floor for the first 3 months in recovery, 3-4 months in recovery. And that's how I got sober. And he said to me very simply, he said, Luke, this is what you got to do. He says, you can't get loaded. You got to go to meetings. And you got to find a job. You know? And it was like, do you realize how screwed up I am? I mean, I didn't think that. I thought I was cool. But, you know, I was like, why do I got to do that? You know, I'm just looking for another person to manipulate. Another person to take care of me, right? Somehow to be able to stay out of the cold rain. Because, you know, that's a terrible time of year. You know, it rains in November, especially in Northern California. So, and anyway, so Ray put me up, and I met this woman. Her name was Pam. And Pam and I got together. She had 20 years, and I had like 3-4 months. Right? And it was like all the newcomer thing, and all that guy's really sick, stay away from him. And you had to walk through all that stuff, right? But what Pam gave me was unconditional love, right? And you know how I was talking about where it hits you at your core and you get broken? She healed that. She healed that. She made me feel I was worthy again. She made me feel like there was hope in this world for me. She loved me back into recovery. You know? We had like 13 years together, and she passed on. And 12 years, I had 12 years of recovery at the time. Almost 13, but we were married for 10. And, you know, we discounted what other people thought and what other people said about us, but we made it together and we did good together. You know, but that broke my heart in recovery. And that was the hardest thing I've ever been through in my life, bar none. You know, and I had people at my house in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were at my house 24 hours a day, 7 days a week when hospice came and brought her home so she could pass it on. And people were bringing food and hanging out, and we had pots of coffee, and, you know, it was just a total feeling of just love and support that my wife got, but I also got to feel that, right? And, you know, I got totally insane about 12, 13 years sober, 14 years sober. I got like homicidal and suicidal because I just lost my wife. And my job changed. I lost 30% of my income. And I just refinanced my house. And now it was like, I got a daughter, Lauren. She's in school up in San Francisco, going to school. And it's like, how am I going to do this? And I got angry. Totally insane, man. 12 years sober. 12, 14 years sober. And my sponsor sat me down at the Pismo, up at Pismo, and he said, did you turn your life over to the care of God? And I said, yes, I did. And that's when he told me, and then he tripped it on something. And right there, all the anger and all the confusion and everything just dissipated, went away. It was like, okay, God, you got this. I got this. And, you know, I prayed this prayer, you know, God, I'll do whatever it is you want me to do. Show me what it is you want me to do, and I'm going to follow you no matter what. Because, you know, my limited thinking got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the best I could do with my plan. Now, since I turned my will and life over to the care of God, I've been able to meet wonderful, most loving people in the world. I've gotten to be married one time. I've got the experience being there for somebody passing. I still am a father to her daughter, who is my daughter. I raised her since she was 8, 9 years old. I now have a grandson from her. And, you know, and I was single for like 7 years after Pam died. And I dated different women, you know, some in the program, some out of the program. And I finally met someone who was my friend for 6 years before we started dating. She was married, so I bet it But her husband wanted me to take her to meet, so I took her to meet. But we never crossed over. We never did anything like that. It was respectful. And she had left him, like, when she first got in recovery. And then for a year, and then went back to live in for 6 more years, and then we got together. She left him, and then we got together, and we crossed over and started a relationship. And we're married today. You know, my life is good. I've been able to find love in here again. I've been able to, you know, to buy another home. I've been able to, you know, stay sober through it all, primarily. You know, that's paramount, right? Because the only thing that really matters is that if I stay sober, whether it's wife, no house, all that kind of stuff, it doesn't matter. What matters is that I trust this loving God here, because one more time he showed up, right? When I short-sold my home, the home Pam and I were in, I short-sold that thing. And I rented a room on Suzanne, and I rented a room from her for 2.5 years. And then her daughter needed to move in with their children, and it was like it wasn't big enough for all of us. So, and I needed to go. You know, it was time for me to move on. And I told my sponsor, I said, well, I don't know, man. I guess I'm going to go rent a room. I'm going to find a tell you what my dream is. I said, you know, I need, and he goes, why don't you just go investigate some of that stuff? See, my limited thinking kept me from taking action. He got me to take action. I went and talked to a loan officer. Next thing you know, I bought a house. Within 2 months, I have keys to another home. That doesn't happen without divine intervention, because it went seamless. Okay, there is a, let me tell you how it happened. That happened, I'm working for my brother. I'm back here and working for my brother now. After working for Great White Dental and managing for 11 years, and then they sold the company, that all changed. And so my brother asked me to come back. I worked for him. His bookkeeper, her mom was going to go to Merrill Gardens, going to sell the family home, whatever. Okay. They were going to put it up on the market July 1st. This is June. I'm talking to CD, pre-June. Investigate. Go investigate. Okay, qualify for X. Go ahead, do what you do. I go to her and I say, okay, I will give you full pop offer for this house, but I won't give you a penny more. If your mom wants to take the deal, take the deal. No? Okay. She took the deal. This all happened like in 3 days. Right?
Yeah.
Right? You know, and I'm in that house in like 40 days, 45 days. It was insane. You know, it was insane. And that's the home I live in now. And Lisa and I, it was a picture of her. And we went through that whole home and fixed it all up. You know, and we continue to work on that house. You know? And now we have Lisa's got two kids, Megan and Ashley. And, you know, Megan's out on her own. She just graduated from UCSB and got her degree. And Ashley is at home still. But, you know, I mean, how does a guy like me, who's a hope-to-die drug-free alcoholic, wind up with two loving families in another beautiful home that's beautiful for me, right? In a beautiful home with a beautiful family and have all these opportunities. The loving God that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Divine intervention. If I would have picked up at any one point along the way, this would all have been gone. You know? When my wife was passing, and I had to medicate her, you know, I had a 600 bottle, milliliter bottle of morphine, and I had to medicate her. And that's why I'm in the bathroom. And I go, you know, I'll drop it. And I'm looking at that thing, and I'm just dying on the inside, right? My wife's in the bed dying, and we have to medicate her. And I'm thinking to myself, I know exactly what that will do. That'll take this away. And God spoke to me in there. He said, if you do this, you ruin everything. You have to feed it. And isn't that really the story of our lives? My life, anyway. That I never wanted to feel life on life's terms. Alcoholics Anonymous is not for the faint of heart. It's not. You know, you have to walk through the ups and downs of daily living and the trials and tribulations. We're not exempt from life. We're just re-engaged. We're just re-engaged. Yeah. For the first time in our life, we get to be part of rather than apart from behind chemicals and alcohol. And I'd like to thank you all for allowing me to share tonight. I think I'll see you ready to jump.
Let's give Luke another round.